This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. You're tuned into the Kenai Conversation. I'm Sabine Pooks. Our guest today is author Tom Kazaya. Tom was a newspaper reporter for the Anchorage Daily News when he traveled for the first time to McCarthy, a town on the edge of Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. He's still writing about McCarthy, most recently in Cold Mountain Path, his newest book released earlier this month. Tom is also the author of Pilgrim's Wilderness, about McCarthy's Pilgrim family, and The Wake of the Unseen Object, which he re-released this year. For years, he covered the Kenai-Soldotna area for the Anchorage Daily News. Now he lives in Homer and is with us in the studio today. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for being here.
It's great to be back to Kenai.
If you have any questions for Tom, we'd love to hear them. Don't be shy. Give us a call at 283-8414. Again, that's 283-8414. We'll repeat that number later in the show. So, Tom, first of all, congratulations on your book. We have some copies here in the studio. It's a beautiful book, and it was printed in McCarthy by a new micropress called Porphyry Press. Can you tell us a little bit about the origin of this book? Why did you decide to return to McCarthy in your writing years after you published your last book, which also kind of centered in McCarthy?
Yeah, well, so it was printed actually in Canada, but the publisher is based out of McCarthy. I don't want to give an impression of a big printing press out there in the wilderness, but it is an eccentric place to run a publishing house from. But it was connected initially to this book just in a natural way. So I have a cabin in McCarthy and have been, you know, back and forth out there ever since I first went out there. So I fell into the Pilgrim family story because of my acquaintance with the community, and covered that for the Anchorage Daily News, and then eventually wrote the book. As I continued to go, you know, I had a lot of connections within the community. So when I wrote the Pilgrim book, I wrote these chapters about this fascinating history of what the place was like before it was a national park. You know, it became a national park in 1980, but for 50 years, you know, it was a ghost town with people coming and going. Because, you know, once the Kennecott copper mine shut down during the Depression, there was nothing out there, and that nothing attracted certain types of people. And so I thought that was a really interesting story. And I had written a couple chapters in the Pilgrim book about that. And my editor in New York said, you know, this is interesting stuff, but it slows down the story, because the Pilgrim story was all about really about the children trying to escape from their father. And, you know, to pause and to tell the history just slowed things down. So I boiled the history down to a page or two in that book. But when I did a reading out at Kennecott for my neighbors, they all wanted to hear the chapters that I had pulled out, you know, the lost chapters. And so I read from those and, you know, like about the story of Raven, the drug dealer who moved out there and dug up skulls from the town cemetery and had candles burning in the skulls as a, you know, on his desk, and just these amazing characters and stories. And people wanted more. And I said, well, let me just, I'll write it up as a little book for a fundraiser for the local museum. And that was the initial idea, but the material was so great. And I found, you know, 3 years later, I was sort of finally coming up for air. I'd gotten so much material, it was a whole book. And we are donating some of the royalties here to the museum, but it kind of went beyond that initial concept of salvaging the history chapters and really expanded them, because people were willing to talk. And, you know, it's amazing to have access to a place that was really kind of like the old Alaska. You know, like it was almost like a 19th century kind of atmosphere out there, well into the oil age in Alaska. It was a unique opportunity to kind of go back and tell those stories while there were still people around who remembered that and could talk about it. So I was able to string this chronology together of this 50-year period. and ending with the park.
Right. And you mentioned, of course, the phrase ghost town, which is in the subtitle of the book as well. How do you define ghost town? What is a ghost town?
The reason I think ghost towns are important in Alaska is you know, the sort of frontier myth up here is development and success and growth and exciting new projects, and we celebrate those. But part of the story is also the failure or what's left behind when the success moves on. You know, as I was coming up here, I remembered coming to Kenai and writing a story about the opening of the new cars. And Kenai was so excited that they had like a parade with a brass band, you know, marching down the highway.
There was a parade for the new cars?
Yeah, from the old cars to the new cars.
Oh my goodness.
And, you know, it was a great, you know, little story. But I went back to the old cars, and the second half of my story, as I recall, was about, like, what are these people going to do now? These little shops in this place that, you know, it's kind of been hollowed out. It was kind of a ghost town, and as I drove by, it sort of still looked like a bit of a ghost town mall. I mean, that's... So ghost town in a big sense means, you know, what's left behind. I got up here a little early today, so I drove up to Agrium and realized I was, you know, that was my ghost town instinct coming up to sort of see what's, you know, what's been abandoned and how does life reform around that. And certainly McCarthy had a really dynamic community that grew up in the ruins, basically. And so it was a kind of half collapsing, half going back to nature world, and half persisting and recovering and building something new. But it was built around that idea of staying remote and staying separate from this, you know, modern pipeline era that was transforming the rest of Alaska.
Sure. And of course, the people who are drawn in by that sort of community, they're really interesting people. And the characters, as you alluded to talking about Raven, the characters you have in this book are just incredible. Like, you couldn't make them up if you tried. They're just so wonderful and interesting and independent. And the stories of how they get up to McCarthy are hilarious and whimsical. When you're writing a book like this and trying to fit in so many different characters, how do you kind of make sure you're doing them justice? And how do you know that you're kind of capturing their essence, including the folks who are no longer alive, who you can't really just kind of sit down with?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, you try to make them come alive on the page. And I think a lot of that it takes place in the rewriting process. I felt like, especially with this book, I had to do a lot of research and pulling together old stories and getting it written down. And then I had this kind of string of stories, but there's a problem with local history writing that sort of, you write that first draft, you put it all into the page and then publish it. And you don't really have a story about necessarily something bigger. It's just sort of discrete little profiles and stories of individuals.
Almost like vignette-like.
Yeah, yeah, which is fine. And actually, as a journalist, I used to love finding local histories like that. It's kind of like this naive folk art, you know, and I would extract stories that I could use in my journalism from those, but I wanted this to be something more than that. I didn't want it to kind of wander. Certainly the reason the Pilgrim's Wilderness book was so successful nationally was that it had a kind of galloping plot. And you can't really find a galloping plot in, 50 years of a ghost town, but I did want it to sort of one story to lead to the next. And so that was all in the rewriting. And so sometimes the things that I would emphasize about a certain character would be the things that would contribute to that bigger story that I was trying to tell about McCarthy. So that was, you know, a sort of a guiding influence on me. And again, you know, I think I had about an extra year on this book after we could have published it maybe a year ago, but it just seemed like it was, you know, not a great time in the beginning of the pandemic to come out with a book. So, so in tinkering and sort of sitting up late at night reading it over, I really did a lot of revision, and I think found more of the deeper stories, the ghost town themes, as well as the sort of why is this person important to the story. And, you know, there are people who didn't make the cut. Even in a ghost town, you can't include every person. So trying to figure out why add somebody and not another is, you know, that exclusion is something that I've learned over the course of a career as a writer. You know, leaving things out can really help the finished product. So that was all in the writing process and not so much in the reporting. The reporting process on a book like this, you feel like a prospector. I think I wrote a lot about the old miners out there. And, you know, even though I'm, you know, my politics tend toward the green, I just loved writing about these old miners and prospectors, just because they were just had so much freedom and so cantankerous, and I felt like I felt like a miner myself. You know, when I'd find a new source of a story or a, you know, I'd just go Eureka, you know.
I love that parallel. That's really funny. You know, you mentioned exclusions, and kind of notably absent, at least I was thinking about this during the book, is that the Pilgrim family's not really in this book. And obviously your last book was about the Pilgrim family. Was that a very conscious decision to kind of leave them out of this telling of McCarthy?
Well, so this book starts essentially in 1938 when they closed the mine. And so the first chapter is really the last train leaving. And then it ends in the early 80s when the national park was created. The Pilgrims didn't show up until 2003. So what was interesting and historically about them was that they were using the mythology of the pre-park world to try to justify, well, the father especially, try to justify the things that he wanted to do and the things.
And Rick Kenyon, who's in this book, he's part of that too in the Pilgrim book.
Uh huh. Yeah. But this was a more sort of friendly, you know, sympathetic view of him.
And his newspaper.
Yeah. Yeah, but that all came, really, even the newspaper came after the period here of this this book. Mm-hmm. You know, those all kind of happened after. So it was pretty easy. Anything after 1983, after the murders, then that was, you know, that was the modern day. Mm-hmm. So I do have an epilogue when most of this book is kind of the one thing that really I tried to tie it together with was the story of Jim Edwards, who was a homesteader out there who had lived through most of this whole period. And he actually, when he got there in the early 50s, he knew some of the old timers who had stayed around when the trains left and buried them in the cemetery. And so his life became a kind of thread that you could string these other stories along. When he died in 2016, his memorial provided me with an epilogue, you know, a chance for when everybody got together out there at his homestead and looked back. So that was my closing. And in that leap into the present, I could describe sort of McCarthy in its modern phase of, you know, reality TV and the Pilgrims and the National Park and, you know, like they had this reality TV show out there, Edge of Alaska, I think it's no longer, but it was from 3 years or so on the Discovery Channel. And I was fascinated because they never copped to the fact that this community was in the middle of a national park or the biggest national park in the country. It was all about frontier living and, you know, living in the wilderness and all that stuff that totally was driving McCarthy in the time that I've written about in Cold Mountain Path. But in the present day, it's kind of a memory in that you've got this blanket of federal regulation over the land use in the area. But they never, I mean, they referred vaguely to federal land once in a while, but, you know, they didn't, even though there was like national park rangers standing there watching them film to make sure nobody got hurt, they never,
right,
you know.
It's kind of a funny, the mythology versus the reality in a sense, almost.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
it was a rich opportunity for me to actually do the, write about the reality, you know, the pre-park reality.
Yeah. The chronology of this book is really interesting, and you split it up into three parts, four if you include kind of that epilogue. Did you have a favorite part to kind of parse through? Did you write all of those sections kind of independently of one another? When you're thinking about the time frame, did you think about them as really having McCarthy having these kind of very concretely distinct historical kind of moments?
You know, not so much the moments. I think there was an evolution over time, and the first part is really kind of the last miners in the area, trying to, they went in, for 3 years they went in and tried to re-mine the old Kennecott mines, you know, but only picking up the stuff on the ground outside. And, you know, the Kennecott mines had a tram, like a 3 mile tram that came down because the mines were on the top of the mountain, if you've ever been out there, and the mill town was down by the glacier. So they had this long tram, and when they closed down the mines, Governor Greening was trying to promote the idea of a ski area. He thought we could use these trams, or at least as a ski lift or as a chairlift for tourists or something. But by the 60s, when these guys bought the rights to the mine, they bulldozed this switchback road up that side of that mountain, and they were trying to mine it with dump trucks, and they were like coming down this incredible switchbacks with these dump trucks of ore. And one guy said that they actually drove with the door open, the driver door open, in case the brakes failed, because you know, it was like straight down switchbacks with these really heavy loads. So kind of preposterous, and it didn't really work out economically as it turned out, because then they had to fly the ore from there, having no train anymore to haul it out. Anyway, that was the early period and that sort of energy. And then the park politics started to come in, and that was kind of the middle section. It was not just the park politics, but it was that whole back to the land era where young people were moving out there to kind of find an alternative lifestyle. And they were really, it was great to be able to get their stories. And they gave a kind of ethos to the area that said, we like it out here the way it is. And there was also a whole university program that came in at that point from the University of Santa Cruz in California.
The one that kind of made its home at the hardware store, right?
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And they had a summer program that they'd bring in college students to study the environment and the history. And they kind of gave a thoughtfulness to the area that, you know, kind of self-reflected interest that added a whole layer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that whole period was kind of the hippie period, mm-hmm. and the state, and it was also, you know, the state, you keep feeling in this story the pressures from the outside world to come in. The state wanted to build a road. At one point they were talking about, you know, putting a bridge across the Copper River and a bridge across the Kennecott River into town and building a paved two-lane highway, you know, to federal road standards in 60 miles into this ghost town. And everybody who lived there, and, you know, the dozens who lived in the region, said, well, you can't do, if you do that, McCarthy won't be here anymore if you could drive to it.
Mm-hmm.
It would be something different.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a real interesting battle that went on, and it kind of went against the common Alaska ethic of, well, yes, let's build a road and let's develop and let's get, you know, an economy in here and get some jobs for young people and, you know, all the things that we are accustomed to hearing on the Kenai Peninsula. And but there was a lot of resistance out there to that. And in some ways, there was more resistance to the road being built than there was to the park. I mean, people in Alaska, generally, there was a anxiety about what's going to happen if a lot of this federal land turns into national park. Are we going to be excluded from our traditional uses? If we live on an inholding, are they going to try to run us out the way they did the hillbillies out of that, you know, the Appalachians when they built, you know, some of the Shenandoah Park and the Great Smoky Mountain Park? They kind of ran the people out of the woods to make it back into untrammeled nature. And they didn't want to see that happen in Alaska. So that was a lot of the debate during the 70s. What are these new national parks going to be like? And so there was some, you know, the people who lived out in McCarthy had a stake in that, certainly. But they weren't, because of who they weren't as sort of adamantly opposed. They really weren't trying to push for big development. They were hoping maybe that that the national park could be another means of protecting what they treasured out there. You know, the idea that national parks protect stories as well as landscapes. And like the story of Kennecott Copper, you know, that's so they need to figure out a way to present that as part of the park experience to visitors. Right. But at some point they realized, well, this community living in the wilderness out here, this very small community, it has its own story. Mm. And how do we tell that story? And it's not an easy one to tell because it's inherently unstable because it grows, right? And if it's free to grow, then it tends to get commercialized and built up and you know, grows out of control and you don't have what you used to have. But at the same time, if you say you can't do anything, then it kind of just rots away and disappears. And so they were trying to find that balance between what they were calling arrested decay and arrested growth, you know, trying to find an in-between place where a community could live kind of in that balance with nature. And maybe the park rules could help them do that. At least that was the hope they were looking at there.
It's such an interesting kind of nuanced, you know, situation. And it reminds me of, there was a story in the Atlantic a couple months ago about, it was kind of disrupting the mythology that the national parks kind of arose on this land that was just empty, that there were people living on this land before. And it's really interesting too, in your book, there's even an allusion to the fact that some thought, you know, McCarthy would actually be more magnificent as a national park if the humans of McCarthy were kind of part of it, which was kind of interesting. I mean, that also really touches on the fascination that people have with folks who live in places this remote and with people in Alaska. I mean, this fascination with Alaska and the people of Alaska, is that something that you encounter a lot because you have people from out of state reading your work? I mean, I know you were talking about how this book in some ways was written for a McCarthy audience, but a lot of your writing has been read all over the country, and I'm sure this book will as well. I mean, how would you characterize that fascination with Alaska?
Oh, gee. Well, you know, it's the same, you know, if I can sell the book to the people who watch that that Discovery Channel show, then I'll probably sell a lot of books.
But there's a reality show. There was a reality show in Homer as well.
Oh, yeah? Yep. Yeah. Uh-huh. So I should keep my sarcasm to a minimum. But it's, you know, the Alaska... This was really more, you know, I had a dilemma with this book, or conceiving this book, about whether I should try to publish it in New York. You know, like my last book was published by Crown and got a big push nationally, or to do it in Alaska. And you know, a local history of a local place, it's kind of hard sell nationally, you know, but the Alaska part would help. But really, I found that in New York, they really wanted to focus it on the mass shooting out there, which occurred in 1983, and absolutely does take up the last third of my book, but it's not a book about that. And so to make it more than that, I felt like this is a book I should do for Alaska. Mm-hmm. If people are interested in Alaska, they might find that compelling, but it's not going to be the kind of true crime book that even the Pilgrim's Wilderness turned out to be sort of classified as a true crime book, because you got engaged with that family's dilemma, and Alaska was kind of the colorful backdrop. You know, Alaska's more in the foreground of this book, this new one. This new story starts with me going out there for the murders. The first time I ever went to McCarthy was as the police reporter for the Anchorage Daily News, flying out there right after the murders had occurred to write about what was, just kind of the shocking crime where six were killed and two wounded. And how could that happen in a ghost town where nobody's living in the middle of winter, you know? So I got there and it was, I was so amazed by what I was finding out there. It's almost like it's been churning in me for 30 years trying to figure out, what do I say about this and how can I address this? So I tell that story right at the beginning of me going out there and my first impressions, and then go back to the last train leaving and begin to tell the story of what was this place that I stumbled on in 1983. And then, of course, the last third, as we get to know the people living out there and all the individuals who were involved on that day, kind of learn their stories. And it, you know, inevitably has this kind of gravitational force that sort of takes over the rest of the story. People were afraid that somehow the national park was going to draw a close to the ghost town era or to the freedoms, you know. But it was, in some ways, it was this mass murder right at the beginning of the park age that had a more, you know, profound impact on the community.
Yeah, I want to talk about that impact. All these years later, you know, does that day still loom really large for the people who live in McCarthy?
It did for an awfully long time, and certainly yes for the few who are still around. But for a long time, people didn't want to talk and were very resentful of tourists showing up and asking nosy questions or sort of rubbernecking type questions. And I think the fact that it's taken me this long to write about it is partly owing to that, to somewhat sharing that or having absorbed that feeling of people in McCarthy. But like a lot of other parts of this book, you know, I think with the passage of time, the story itself was beginning to fade, and it sort of needed to be told once in a coherent and sympathetic way. So I think that people were willing to share with me, what they went through, with a feeling that they were maybe talking to somebody who was not going to just do, you know, a reenactment with flashing police lights and heavy breathing running through the woods and that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, how much do you think does the fact that you kind of have, and you actually, you talk a little bit about this in Pilgrim's Wilderness, how much do you think having this place out in McCarthy and being part of the community, you know, maybe lends itself to having people kind of open up to you with these stories? Like, do you think you'd be able to kind of write in the same way if you didn't have this kind of connection to the community that you do?
Probably not. Yeah, I know. I think it did cause people more to open up. On the other hand, it may have constrained my ability to write about it too. So it's that, for a writer, it's a really double-edged thing. You know, it's sort of, I found that in my first book, The Wake of the Unseen Object, I was writing about rural native cultures and, you know, traveling to those villages, travels that I did for the Anchorage Daily News, and I felt like I was writing as a white outside visitor in the 80s. But I was also an Alaskan, you know, and I was writing about our state. And there was that sort of, one of the tensions that I hope makes the book interesting is sort of working that line between being a outsider and an insider. And, that's, I think, a nonfiction writer in particular has to kind of go back and forth across that frontier. Sometimes you have to take a kind of cold outsider's perspective in order to get the words on the page into a shape that will mean something to somebody who doesn't know anything about the area. But at the same time, you want to write it with compassion for the people who know the story that you're telling intimately and will be concerned if you get something wrong or miss some important nuance. So, I think I did. It was my long engagement with the community that helped make this book possible. Certainly, there were some key interviews and some old interviews that were shared with me, including a week-long interview that Jim Edwards gave to somebody from Santa Cruz shortly after the murders, just telling his whole life story. I got to know Jim well, and I had some great conversations, but I never methodically sat down and got his, then this happened, then this person did that, and this, 130-page transcript of these interviews with him really kind of opened up the possibility of making this a book.